525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year in daylights?
Well, hello everyone. This is Jim David. Happy 2013. Welcome to my podcast. It has been several months since my last podcast, and there are several reasons for that. The main reason is I've been too busy to do it because I've been traveling so much, and some of the people that I had planned to interview had to postpone, because in order to do one of these podcasts, you know, you really do need to be in the same room in the same town at the same time. And I was gone too much, or they were gone, but I'm back, and I'm going to do these podcasts as often as I possibly can. How's that? I mean, I'm sorry for the inconsistency, but there it is. But I'm back. I'm busy. My novel is selling really well. I'm really thrilled. It's getting these random internet reviews out of nowhere that people are really loving it. My novel, You'll Be Swell, which you can still get. It's always going to be on Amazon and Kindle and iPad and Sony e-reader and Nook and all of that good stuff. But the music that you're hearing is, of course, Seasons of Love from Rent. And the guy that I get to talk to today was the star of Rent, Anthony Rapp. He played Mark Cohen, the lead, in the original Broadway cast of Rent, as well as the film. And recently he's been touring with a one-man show called Without You, which is based on his whole experience of Rent. And you may know this. The guy that wrote Rent, Jonathan Larson, died the night before they opened, or the night of the final dress rehearsal or something, in the 90s. And he had a heart problem. But we talk about that in the interview. But that was a crazy experience for the cast. But, of course, Rent went on to be one of the most successful musicals in history. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It won the Tony. And Anthony's done a lot of other stuff since then, but he is just a hilarious, fun, fascinating, and very blunt guy. And I'm really glad I got to talk to him. So here's Anthony. You were born in 1971 in Joliet, Illinois.
I was born in Chicago.
Oh, you were born in Chicago.
But I grew up in Joliet.
What's Joliet like? What was that? I've never heard of it.
Joliet is it's like a blue-collar suburb. And now that Chicago suburbs have sprawled more, it's a little more in part of the greater Chicagoland area. But it was really far enough away that it was kind of its own town. And it was like 80,000 people, so it's not that small. But,
yeah.
But there was nothing there, like, culturally speaking. There was a community theater. And there was an old theater called the Rialto that it was sort of neglected. And I guess I gather in the last like decade or two, it started to get some like non-equity tours through there.
Right.
You know? But Joliet is pretty dead in terms of culture. You know, it's strip malls and car dealerships and, you know. At the same time, however, in my high school, within a few years, myself, John Barrowman, and Andy Dick were all students. John Barrowman, who was his most known thing now is Torchwood. He was the
John, it's Barrowman, it's not Barrowman.
Yeah.
John Barrowman and Andy Dick.
Yes, we all were in high school together.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
And you're all gay.
Yes. Well, Andy's ish. I mean, he's equal opportunity.
He'll nail anything.
He wrote a song, in fact, called "I'll Fuck Anything That Moves," and it's true.
Really?
Yes. So out of this little, you know, town that had not much, and certainly I don't know where it came from, but we all sort of sprouted up out of there.
So now, what was your, so you had a community theater there. So children's theater?
No, it was community theater, like adults and stuff, but I never did anything there because I was working too much, so.
Now, wait a minute. Now, you got your equity card when you were 9 years old?
Yes.
Now, that's the Actors Equity membership. Now,
yes.
How the hell did that happen?
I auditioned for Evita in Chicago and got it. I was nine, yeah. And in the original Hal Prince production, there were four kids in like a couple crowd scenes, and in the Santa Evita number,
yeah.
Please, Mother Ava, will you bless a little child?
Oh yeah, that.
That. But it was, I mean, it was a great experience. I was a kid, you know, I loved it.
And then what did you do after that?
The King and I? No, actually, in the meantime, I did The Little Prince and the Aviator, which was a failed Broadway musical that previewed for 2 weeks and never opened.
How old were you?
10.
Were you the Little Prince?
I was cast as the Fox, the Fennec, and the understudy to The Little Prince, and during rehearsals they fired The Little Prince and promoted me to The Little Prince.
So you were The Little Prince on Broadway.
But we previewed for 2 weeks and closed before.
And never opened.
Never opened.
Why, what was the matter?
It was terrible.
Oh, but, is that why?
But the Niederlanders...
Just like the show I was in, you know.
But you opened.
We opened, and it was the greatest experience of my life till the reviews came out.
Yes. But the thing about The Little Prince and The Aviator is that it was a flop, except they made all their money back because they successfully sued the Niederlanders for kicking them out without... Like, there was some kind of breach of contract situation with closing it. Like,
oh.
I don't know exactly how it worked out, but they made their capitalization back. But so it's the only flop in history to make their money back.
But it was terrible.
I mean, I think it was terrible, yeah.
You must have been the cutest thing.
Well, I don't... I think there's a couple pictures online you could probably find. I don't know, yeah. I mean, I was a little blonde, little kid. Yeah, I don't know. I auditioned, and they were a little worried about casting me as Little Prince because I was young.
Yeah.
So they cast me as the fox.
Yeah.
And made me the understudy, but then during rehearsals... All kinds of shit went down during the rehearsals, though, because, like, other people got shuffled around, and the director got fired. I mean, there were so many things happening.
Who was your director, you remember?
Well, Jerry Adler wound up directing it.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember who the first director was. But it was John Barry and Don Black did the music and lyrics, who, you know, had done, like, James Bond.
He did every James Bond score for a while.
So, I mean, it was, like, they were prestigious. And I don't know what the budget was, but it was not cheap. I mean, it was a Broadway musical. Oh, and Ellen Green was in it, Michael mm-hmm. York.
Michael York?
Mm-hmm.
Was he the aviator?
He was the aviator, and he couldn't really sing too well. But he was so sweet. He was so nice to work with.
So you were 10 years old and you were in Little Prince.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to get out of school
mm-hmm.
and come to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And your parents were cool with that?
Well, my mom was a single mother nurse. I mean, she was just really supportive. I mean, it was, you know, later in life she looked back and we were so naive about so many things, about the business. We didn't know much. And I had an older brother and sister, and there were people who were taking care of them, but it was just all sort of haphazard a little bit, and it was hard on them.
Yeah.
You know, but my mom, she was a very sweet woman. She was so supportive, so she just wanted to make sure that this happened.
What was her name?
Mary.
Mary.
And so Little Prince closed, and then right after that, I auditioned for the King and I national tour with Yul Brynner to play Anna's son, and I got that and did that for a year. On the road.
Wow. So. And here I am doing Jack and the Beanstalk and Puss in Boots and Peter Pan in Asheville, North Carolina, and you're touring with Yul Brynner.
Yes. And then, you know, I did a little bit more summer stock over the next couple of years, and the next sort of big thing I did was the play Precious Sons here in New York
mm-hmm.
when I was 14 with Ed Harris and Judith Ivey that Norman Renee directed. George Firth wrote it. And it didn't run super long. It ran only for a couple months, but it was a really amazing.
What must that have been like as a teenager to have a career all of a sudden?
I mean, I never thought of it as a career. I was just working. I was just doing stuff.
You,
I mean,
that's, you know, it was like, how much do we hate you right now? Because everybody has been dying to do exactly what you did. And you're like, oh, I don't know. I just have the fun.
It's true.
Yeah, God, we fuck you.
Yeah, well, yeah. What can I say?
That's great.
I was lucky.
So it was just your way of life.
Yeah, I mean it was. And my mom, you know, she was the eldest of 13 kids. Lived a very simple, like we lived a very simple, basic, you know, nose to the grindstone life.
Right.
And so it wasn't ever like about glamour. It was just about like doing something that I loved and that, you know, was beneficial. I mean, certainly I made a little money from it. Whatever.
Sure.
It was really just to be supportive of her children. Like, my brother was an athlete, and then he became a writer later in life.
Adam.
And my sister, she's a mom. I mean, she didn't have one of those interests that we had as a kid, but, you know.
Right.
Our mom would have done anything for us to make sure that our dreams, or, you know. And it wasn't even like I had a dream. It wasn't like I was sitting around as a kid going, I dream about being on Broadway. It was just what I was just did theater, and then I loved it, and then there were people around who were encouraging my mom to take me to audition for professional work, and then she was like, okay.
That's wild.
It's wild. It's wild. She was like anti-stage mother. I mean,
well, you know what? You must have been good, though. You must have had just natural talent that
I guess
you
I
can't
did.
Teach.
Yeah, I guess I had, you know. I remember when I was 14 in that play, I asked Norman Renee, I was like, why did you cast me? And he said, because of your honesty as an actor. So I thought that was nice.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something that I certainly try to do. I mean, I feel like it's just something that I've always had.
I think it's part of your personality. I think you're just a very on the level. You're not frills.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have this veneer. that so many people have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's why I get along with you, because you are just very much there. And you probably have a really good bullshit detector, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although sometimes, I mean, I've found out in the last couple of years, I've met a couple of people who had told me all sorts of lies, and I believed them about their life. It was like,
well, that's impossible to detect.
Yeah.
If somebody just flat out says to you, oh, by the way, I was this close to getting cast in blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
How are you going to know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my bullshit detector, I feel, is strongest in people's work. I get allergic to certain performers when I just feel like they're just doing something super technical.
Well, that's why it really meant a lot to me when you told me that you liked my comedy, because, you know, you wouldn't have said anything otherwise.
It's true. I'm really bad at that.
Yeah.
I can't go backstage and say, you know, I if anything, I would just say thank you or congratulations.
Do you have one of those funny stories where, you know, your friend was in a show and it was just hideous and you had to say something?
No, I've been pretty lucky. I mean...
Oh, okay.
Apparently, you remember Geraldine Page?
Yeah.
Apparently, she used to, she would tell people, you were up there, and you were on that stage, and you said those lines. You were wearing those costumes.
Yeah. Elaine Stritch tells a story about she doesn't know what to say, so she just went backstage and said to somebody who gave a terrible performance, she went back and said, oh, you. That's it.
Yeah.
So then, what happened leading up to Rent? I mean, how old were you when you got Rent?
I was 22 when we did the workshop.
Oh, okay. So you were that young.
Yeah. I turned 23 right afterwards. I mean, I did a lot of things in the meantime. I started doing some film stuff in the intervening years.
Is that when you did Adventures in Babysitting?
Yeah, Adventures in Babysitting was my first one when I was 15. That was a blast. I was spoiled by that, because it was so much fun. Really nice people. It was really...
And Chris Columbus directed that, right?
And it was so sweet. And it was really... It was just a blast. It was just so fun.
Yeah.
And movies are not always fun. The next big thing I did in New York was 6 Degrees of Separation. I was in the original cast of that.
With Stockard Channing and John Mahoney?
John Mahoney. No, not John Cunningham.
John Cunningham.
John Mahoney and Stockard Channing were in House of Leaves.
Oh, okay. Together. I can't keep my guare straight.
Yeah. So that was also, that was such a huge success, and it was a really amazing play to be a part of.
How did you end up auditioning for Rent, even? They called you in?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been at an agency for a number of years at that point, and there was a new agent who got promoted from an assistant, and the first meeting we had on his desk was the breakdown for the workshop of Rent. So it was just a 10-performance studio production, they called it, at the New York Theater Workshop.
Right.
And I knew Michael Greif because I'd auditioned for him and I'd seen a couple things that he directed. And I was a big admirer of his. And even though I hadn't gotten the thing I'd auditioned for him for, it was a good audition experience. So I had a really strong connection to him. I felt really good about him. So I, you know, just went in an audition and then got called back on the spot, which doesn't, as you know, doesn't almost never happens, which is...
It actually happened to me on my Broadway musical. Yeah. I just walked in there and got it.
They gave it to you on the spot?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened was I went into the casting. The casting director had seen me for another play, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, with Neil Simon, that I didn't get. But then when Whorehouse Goes Public came along, they were looking for a comedian. That was the part. A comedian.
Yes.
And they were actually looking for an old Catskills kind of guy. Mm-hmm. They had Freddie Roman come in. They had... You know, Shecky Green, they had everybody. And so I went to the Nederlander Theater, and Tommy Toon and Carol Hall and Larry, all the writers and the producers and all the, 10, 15 people are all sitting in the audience. And I walked on stage, and I said, my name is Jim, my Christian name is James, my Jewish name is Rochmeil. And they started laughing. And then I said, my Fire Island name is Gladys. And Tommy Toon went, ah!
It's like you stabbed him.
Like that, yeah. And then they were screaming with laughter, and then immediately they had me stick around and read the dialogue that I'd been given. And I said, by the way, I tried these jokes out at Caroline's. None of them work. And then I got it. So much of the time, that's what happens, is you just walk in and you get it. They called you in for Rent, and you sang Losing My Religion.
Yes, the R.E.M. song.
Did that kill?
I mean, I don't know if it killed. I mean, it got me a callback.
Right.
And I done it in my I had a really wonderful acting coach that I'd been working with off and on for the years that I'd been living in New York, and she had done an exercise called the hero exercise, where you take someone you really admire and you really respect and you do something as them. But it's not about impersonating them. The goal of the exercise is to access that part of them that you admire and find it in yourself. And Michael Stipe was one of my heroes. Like, I've always really been drawn to rock and roll singers and performers when they have that kind of, he's always been like this creature, and there's this spirit that comes through him, and he's a little odd too, but I just always found him so compelling. So I'd done that song in that class, and it sort of broke open something for me that I could do that.
So you did it as Michael Stipe.
I mean, that's the thing. It wasn't about being...
No, but you in your head.
No. It's not even... That's the thing. It wasn't like being him. It was embodying the thing about him that was heroic to me.
Correct.
If that makes
sense. Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be like doing, like, you know, the extreme case would be like if Liza was my hero, it wouldn't be like doing an impersonation of Liza. It would be about like trying to capture that crazy, when she's at her best, that amazing energy that she has. Which I'm not saying Liza's my hero. I'm just saying like trying to, draw
a parallel. Yes, you are.
She's fine. I've met her a couple times over the years. Charlie Brown and Rent, she came backstage, and she was very nice both times.
Mm-hmm.
She was lovely both times.
Well, she's a big Broadway baby. Yeah. She loves the whole thing,
Yeah.
So when you started the workshop of Rent, when you started the rehearsals, how soon did you know this was something?
The first moments of rehearsal after we started learning Seasons of Love. That was the first thing we did.
Oh, really?
In rehearsal. And then I knew that this was something really special.
Really?
Yes. And then that night I went home and I listened to the rest of the score, and things were really cool, but the next thing that really jumped out at me and knocked me out was La Vie Bohème. And especially in the song towards the end of the song, when everybody says together, "To faggots, lesbians, dykes,
cross-dressers,
to people living with, not dying from disease."
Yeah.
And
that's astounding.
Yeah, in 1994,
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, there had been Angels in America,
mm-hmm.
and there had been The Normal Heart,
uh-huh.
and there had been Falsettos,
yeah.
but there hadn't been anything like this broad, like encompassing everyone together, and in a musical, in a rock musical.
It was the first musical that I can recall that had gay characters that didn't mention it.
Yeah,
they just were.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing something. That's exactly true. They were just who they were.
They were just who they were. Yes. And that was... It's astonishing, but that's revolutionary.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Because it's always... The gay thing in every play, and even now, I'm trying to write a screenplay, and I'm trying to keep that issue out of it. But it just creeps in because it's so a part of gay people's lives. We have to come out all the time.
Yeah.
I have to come out...
Yes.
Whenever I'm doing my stand-up to a straight audience,
yes.
they don't know. 90% of them, they don't know. So then all of a sudden, I have to say, okay, now how am I going to do this?
Yes.
And I have to... It's very awkward.
Yeah.
And annoying. When did you decide to be out professionally? When did you decide I'm not even going to worry about this?
When I did a play of Larry Kramer's, The Destiny of Me.
Oh.
I replaced John Cameron Mitchell in it.
Oh.
And I had met Larry before that. I'd done a reading of the play before that. And he had really... He was an amazing person to be around.
Larry Kramer?
As a young... I was... What was I? 20? 19? 20? Something like that.
Yeah.
When I first met him.
And he wrote The Normal Heart.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. So that was really galvanizing. And to be around that. And then... So when I was in that play... I mean, it was like, at the Lord's Hell, like 500 people saw it. But I thanked my then partner in my bio.
Oh, okay.
And that's how I came out. And then...
At 20?
It was, 20 or 21. I can't remember exactly.
Boy, and so you didn't worry about what this is going to do to my career?
I didn't care.
You didn't care. Good for you.
I mean, it's just...
Look at you.
I don't mean to sound like highfalutin about it.
Look at you. I mean, look at all the angst and anxiety.
Yeah.
But that's really ballsy at age 20 to just not care.
I mean, and then the best thing that started to happen about being out was what I was hoping for, which was when Rent happened, young people started talking to me, which is about, and like sharing, like the main reason I wanted to do it was to be something of a role model or example, or be available to young people to
be of service.
Be of service and mentoring and stuff like that. And so I started getting like incredible emails and letters and
people pour their heart out to
yeah,
you.
And that was very meaningful. So
I bet it was. Tell me what it was like when Jonathan died.
The news of him dying was, to say it's shocking is the understatement. I mean, he hadn't been feeling well, but there was no indication he was going to die.
Right.
He had been like lightheaded and nauseous and a little bit of chest pains, but he'd gone to the emergency room, two emergency rooms, and, sent home. There was no way that anyone thought he was going to die. So it was crazy. And then we had to figure out what,
how. So he just collapsed in the kitchen, right?
In the kitchen at his...
And have an aortic aneurysm?
Yeah, but it was like an aortic dissection, it turned out, which is related to Marfan syndrome, which no one knew that he... Which was an
undiagnosed condition. Which is like, but it's like a tear in your heart.
Yes.
That nobody knew
he had. Operable.
But it's operable. So he could have, if they had detected it...
Yes, it's possible.
He would still be with us.
I mean, it's very possible. It's got a very high success rate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's complicated.
Right.
It's tough, but it's not like a death sentence by any means.
Right.
He was 35. I mean, we were already incredibly in love with his show and loved him. But, after he died, it was just like, well, now this we have to do whatever we can do to make this a hit, to make him to live on in his, in his work, for his legacy to continue. So it just bound us together in the most amazing way. I mean, in the face of crises, people can either really fall apart or they can come together, and we really came together.
So yeah. And you did the show for him. You must have all been sobbing on opening night.
Yeah. But then we learned how, when you cry, your throat kind of closes up.
Uh-huh.
You had to, when you sing, it has to be, open.
Yeah.
We had to learn how to do both. It was kind of weird.
Wow.
But there's you can't try to shove that stuff down. It's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
It's too strong. And
so then
we were performing material that was a funeral in the show.
Right.
So it was like everything, the life and art were like, the distance between them was tissue paper thin. And we were, that first night we did a sing through for his friends and family. And so they were all in the room and we were all in the room. And it was, but it was also incredible. It was one of the, there was this energy in the room too. And the presence of his genius and his life force and his vision, and then all of our energy and there, it was just like, it was all, there was nothing funereal about that performance. It was celebratory also, which is what the show is. That's what the show is. The show is that.
What was that opening night of Rent like?
You mean Off-Broadway or Broadway?
Off-Broadway. Off-Broadway.
It was a great opening night, but honestly, just like any other opening night, we were a little on edge because we knew we needed the critics. It's just there was a lot of buzz about it. People were really loving it, whatever. But you just, for a new show like that at the time, it just seemed like there would be no way we could be the kind of success that we were hoping would be without the critics. And I didn't know if the critics were going to go for it because the critics can be really cynical. And the show is sort of anti-cynicism.
Yeah.
At its core. It's giving a big finger to cynicism. And thankfully, 95% of the critics gave us a rave.
When did you realize this is something that has not come before?
Oh, I knew that from the first workshop.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah, I knew that. And, just the fact that it was multicultural, that there were multiracial relationships, and the gay relationship, the lesbian relationship, and the straight relationship, and there was no differentiating between them, and, all of that, for sure. There was nothing like it. And the kind of rock music, that it was real rock music. It wasn't like some water.
Well, I think what I meant was, when did you realize this is a phenomenon?
Oh, a phenomenon.
That's what I meant.
Sorry.
That's what I meant. Not the material.
Oh, no, sorry.
Although that was interesting.
I guess when we went on, the reviews happened, and then there was like a media frenzy. We were doing like photo shoots for Vanity Fair and Vogue and, I mean, for a musical, it was crazy. and on the cover of Newsweek, and somewhere in there we all...
I remember that Adam and Daphne were on the cover of Newsweek. Electrifies Broadway, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a ridiculous memory for bullshit I haven't thought about in 30 years.
And then they announced we were moving to Broadway, and then when we went on sale, we set a record for like the number of tickets sold in a period of time or something like that. So that all seemed like it was pretty clear that it was becoming something of a phenomenon, but at the same time, there were people, I found this out later, there were people who were offered the chance to invest in the show who said, it's not going to work on Broadway. They're feeling foolish.
They probably invested in the Anna Nicole Smith makeup centers.
Sure, sure.
Or the Willie Nelson dry cleaning stores.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So then you went to Broadway, and what was that opening night like?
That opening night was just pure celebration, because we were already a hit. There was no fear of anything.
And you just you probably just came out and performed the motherfucker.
Yeah, and the other thing about it on a personal level is it was the only night my mom was able to see it, because she had been ill, but she was well enough to come, and so she was there that night. And it was such the culmination of everything that I'd worked for my whole life up to that point that she'd been such a part of, and she was there in the front row of the mezzanine.
That must
and
have been
she saw that.
That must have been really something.
It was something. It was the greatest night of my life.
Before or since, do you think?
Both, yeah. And probably forever.
You think so?
You know, I mean, just in terms of everything coming together, I don't think that...
Everything.
There will ever... You know, nothing could match that, but that's okay.
You are the star of the biggest Broadway musical smash since A Chorus Line, probably. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know...
And your mom is ill with cancer.
Yes.
And she had been feeling bad, and then she's able to come.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Check that off the bucket list.
Yes.
So then how long did you stay in Rent?
I stayed in New York for almost 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And then I knew I wanted to, if given the chance, I wanted to go to London, because that had been a dream. And
uh-huh.
We found out that they were going to finally do the London production, that they were going to bring over a few of us. And
so uh-huh.
That was how I decided what my last performance would be, so I'd have a little break between them, because it was exhausting, too. I mean, it was amazing to be a part of, but it was exhausting.
The show?
Well, the show and everything else that was going on in my life at the same time was... Like,
so your mom lived for how much longer after opening night?
A year.
Oh, so, but you were going back and forth.
Yeah, but she was really bedridden for the last few months of her life, and she wasn't well enough to travel before then either. So it was, it was all really overwhelming, exhausting. Plus, I was in a really rotten relationship.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I was too pussy to get out of. I mean, pussy. I mean, I was going through all that stuff. I didn't want to be alone during that time.
Mm.
You know, it was a mess, though. It was a mess. I was really stressed out.
So it's like you experienced, in that period, it's like you experienced all the highs and lows that life can offer.
Yes.
So it was like, what mood am I in now?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, the show was always, always, always safe haven. Always. I mean, except a couple times it was just exhausting. Like, I was just wiped out by it, you know. But and the response was always amazing from the audience.
What is it like to sing an entire show?
It's intense. But I like that kind of challenge, though. I like, you know, I wouldn't want to do that every day.
So then you did Rent in London, and then?
And then came back from London and right away started Charlie Brown.
On Broadway,
yeah,
playing Charlie Brown.
Well, the we toured for a few months, a couple months before then we came into New York, yeah, and that was a great experience too. It was it didn't run as long as we hoped. The audience response was amazing.
Of course, it was.
We got great critical response out of town, and then including from tough critics like the Chicago Tribune head critic, you know, and then we come in and Ben Brantley takes a big dump all over it, although he does vault Kristen Chenoweth within his superstardom, which she deserves because she's fantastic. But
he says he talks the whole review is about her.
Yes,
basically.
Like five paragraphs about her,
and then zero about you.
Well, one line that sort of was kind of negative about me, but the whole show he didn't like. And one of the things he said in the review was something like the energy in the audience was like a vacuum. And I know the night he was there, and it was like a rock concert. So, you know...
You wonder, what do these people see? What are they doing? What have they got up their ass? What's going on?
I don't know. It's weird. I've been doing my show without you, which is about all the things we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book, and it's based on that. And we did it in Edinburgh, in London, in August and September of last year. And I got... Like, there's so many outlets reviewing things in the Edinburgh Fringe.
Right.
There's like 15 or more.
Right.
I got like 8 or 9 5-star reviews, and then I got 2 2-star reviews. I get the only thing that really makes me mad you know, is when they say things that are just wholly inaccurate. It's not even a matter of opinion. Like when there was a review of my show that said I spent a lot of time in the show having people praise my work. The only person in my show who says anything about me, my work, is my mom. No one else does. They say things about the show. They say things about Rent, you know, for instance. So that's just like, if you're going to criticize something, fine, just be accurate.
Yeah.
You know.
What was the making the movie of Rent like?
It was a blast. It never, if you look through the history of movies that have been made from shows, you never see six people from the original cast in a movie. Never, ever. Never. You maybe see one, maybe. Usually none. The most that I could think of other than this was Streetcar, which had three.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything else that comes close.
I did want to ask you, did you ever feel, since you were out, did you ever feel any pressure to be a good gay role model?
No.
No?
I mean, I've never been like a... I've always lived a pretty low-key life. I'm not like a big... I don't do drugs, really. I drink cocktails or a little bit of wine, you know. So I didn't have to worry about, like, my behavior getting out of hand and, like, proving something wrong about my lifestyle.
Did interviewers ever ask you, like, annoying questions, like, when did you know and, you know, all of that?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I've had different conversations about coming out over the years. None of that ever bothered me, though.
Oh, it didn't?
No. I think it's interesting.
It always bothered me. I always felt like a laboratory specimen.
Oh, yeah.
I always felt like I had to... It's like, what difference does it make? You would never ask somebody who was straight this question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting to turn it around.
Yeah.
And say, like, when did you know? You know, it just as a... Not in a chip on the shoulder way, but, like, an interesting, like, thought experiment way to, like, go to look at it from the other side, you know? No, I mean, I came out... I mean, I embraced the public nature of it. I took it on, like... an opportunity to, if anybody was going to pay attention, I was happy to be a voice.
You seem to be unbelievably well adjusted.
I mean, I had other like emotional adjustments I had to make in terms of, I don't know, learning how to not be always like it was okay to fuck up. I was always such a good boy, and my mom, I was such a golden boy for my mom, that to learn that part of being human is to also have dark corners and fuck up and think bad things and say bad things, you know, to make mistakes, to learn about that. So I wasn't as adjusted to that side of things, but in terms of being adjusted to the limelight or the public eye or the, you know, all that, yeah. But I think that I give so much credit to my mom, because she was, we lived a lower middle class, blue collar, practically, except she, I mean, nurses. Back then, in the 70s and 80s, nurses were not paid well. Now, nurses make a pretty good living,
right,
relatively speaking. But she was great. I don't know how she did it for three kids. I don't know how she did it, but she did it. And so, I mean, it was just never... Nothing was a big deal. It was fun. It was great. It was celebrated. But the work was celebrated. It wasn't about all the trappings and all the stuff around it.
So you're...
And it was also a different time than, like, the nature of celebrity has changed a lot, I think, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, you know, with YouTube and reality television. And, you know, there's this... I mean, I think people have always wanted to be a star, but I just think it's like something's happened in the last little while that make people think that that's something more than it is.
In the internet age,
right.
I don't know that I want everybody on the planet knowing who I am. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because then all of a sudden they write nasty things about you on message boards. And
well, they did that anyway. I mean, they'll do that anyway.
I know.
Did I tell you the one about... I did Henry V in Boston, and somebody, a friend of mine, saw this on the message board. She's like, you might want to look, take a look at this one. He said, "You are fucking clown shoes. Your attempt at Shakespeare made me want to vomit in my mouth. For the love of God, never act again."
Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the show?
And then there was another
guy. You are fucking clown shoes.
Fucking clown. There was another guy who said it's no accident that his last name rhymes with crap. And I actually...
Ooh!
And I actually wrote that.
Ooh!
That was for Charlie Brown.
Well, that was like, I think I told you on the Comedy Central website, somebody said pancreatic cancer is funnier than Jim Davis.
Yes. It's probably true.
I had more fun at my own bris.
Yes. But I actually wrote that guy an email and said, just so you know, you can certainly feel whatever you feel, but there are human beings I'm a human being, so you can maybe think of another way to say what you want to say. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be insulting.
Right.
He wrote me an email apologizing, and then he showed up at the stage door and apologized in person. And I thought that was really big of him. I really did.
Was he cute?
No.
No, of course not.
But I thought that was really something. So, you know. But the internet just gives people such permission to say shit.
Yeah.
It's kind of astonishing sometimes.
Oh, I know. I mean, I was feeling perfectly good about my life until I was reading this article, and then I went to the comments section and saw what, you know, Gold Star 50 had to say about this. And I'm like, ouch. Yeah, how awful.
It's just people are going to think what they're going to think. I mean, there are Academy Award-winning performances that I would rather eat dung than watch, you know, for instance. So there's something for everyone, you know. Mm-hmm. Not everything is for everybody.
Speaking of Academy Awards, then you were also in a movie that won Best Picture of the Year.
Yes.
A Beautiful Mind.
I was.
And what was that like?
That was really cool. I mean, it was very prestigious, and it was very, really talented, smart, interesting people. Ron Howard was lovely to work with. Russell was nice, interesting, intense, really hardworking. I wouldn't say he was like super friendly, but he also wasn't an asshole. You know,
it doesn't have to be friendly.
But he was, and the day that we sat down and did the table read, I was like, Jennifer Connelly's going to win the Oscar, and she did. And it wasn't just that she was so good, because she was so good, but the part. It's just like the awards are as much as anything about the role.
Sure.
And what you get to do in them. You know.
Sure.
Beautiful Mind happened in 2001.
Yeah.
And I had, so from Rent opening on Broadway in 1996, I had worked for the next like 4 years straight without like never more than like a week or two break. And then I hit a wall and didn't work for almost a year. Like nothing was happening. And I started to get really kind of scared and freaked out. Like, not because money was getting a little tight, but I was also like, I thought that I was done with this part of it. I thought that I didn't have to worry anymore. Not that I was going to be like always the star of something or whatever, but that I was going to work.
I've made it.
And no, I hit the wall. And it was like tumbleweeds.
Crickets.
And I was in LA for pilot season, and I, like, the same day that this happened, I had this audition for some TV thing, and the casting director literally didn't even look at me the whole time. She was just, like, looking down at her sheet.
So, you know what? I mean, let that be a lesson let that be a lesson to all actors. It's like, you were the star of the biggest Broadway musical, and it was a smash hit. Your picture and your name were everywhere. And then all of a sudden, nothing.
Nothing. Well, and the same day that I had that audition for this casting director didn't even look at me, I got the call that I'd gotten A Beautiful Mind.
Just out of the blue.
And out of the blue. Bam. So it was a gift in terms of that, for sure, also.
How's everything going right now?
It's been, knock on wood, really great. I mean, my show has been, we've been doing it, we've been waiting to come into New York. We have to wait a little bit longer because the theater that we want isn't available.
But you want to do that off-Broadway?
Yes.
At New World Stages?
Yes.
And run open-ended?
Yeah, I mean, as long as
you can.
As long as I can. I mean, as long as I can hold up doing it. I think I can hold up pretty long doing it. But, you know, I'm curious to see how it'll do. I don't know, you know. We did it in Toronto for 4 weeks, and the audience was wonderful and kept growing throughout, which tells me word of mouth spreads, and so that's a good thing.
Well, listen, it is a real thrill to know you.
Oh, thank you.
It's a real thrill.
Thank you.
Because you're incredibly talented, and you're genuine, and you're also extremely funny.
I haven't been very funny in this podcast.
No, 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 not in this podcast, no.